How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
George Hill in the lane. Turnaround, right-hand push shot, good. George Hill's got 27 points. He is putting it on the paper.
You are Locked On Jazz, your daily podcast on the Utah Jazz.
Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
It is Locked On Jazz for the 15th of May. Player reviews begin today. Summary of their season, analyzing the season through numbers, future contract situation, and how the rest of the league views them. That's how we'll break down each and every player. And today, we look at George Hill. It's all coming up on today's edition of Locked On Jazz. Pow. How are you? I'm David Locke, radio voice of Utah Jazz, Jazz NBA insider. How are you? Hope everything's going well. Enjoying a little. We don't enjoy the offseason. We really would have rather been playing yesterday, no question. Today's show is brought to you by Blue Apron. Thank goodness for Blue Apron this weekend. When wife was out of town, my son and I put together a Blue Apron meal. And from Gemalto. Gosh, their digital security is certainly part of the news today, isn't it? So Gemalto and Dan Spence bring you the show. All right, here's what we're going to do. A few things. I'm kind of going to start playing around with some various different things. Few are. One is we're going to start the player review. We only are doing shows. Actually, we might do a Friday show this week. I don't head down to St. George until. So we'll probably get all five shows in this week. We'll do a player review each day this week and maybe put Shelvin and Howell together and then do, you know, just I'll figure it out what's got enough content to do. Today we're going to do George Hill. And then, as I mentioned, there's a new company out there called 60DB and Locked On NBA. Has done a sponsorship with 60DB or a partnership with 60DB, and I'm producing kind of daily content on 60DB about some of the goings-on in the NBA or PAC or whatever it might be. And so I might throw that on the backside of today's program, or you can just go get it at 60DB. Does that make sense? All right, let's get right to it. And start digging in on George Hill and then get your thoughts. So the story, the big summary on George Hill is that he, you know, the positive is when he played, we were 33-16. In the playoffs, he was certainly important in that Clippers series. At times he was fabulous. At times you could see he was laboring, but he was, you know, 17 point game six. He had 22 game seven. He had 17 points, four rebounds, five assists. We were plus 21 when he was on the floor. And he was vital to who we were as a franchise. Third overall, 37-20, 33-16 during the regular season. But the big number there is 49. It was November 6th that he plays against New York. There's a play, you can see him come up the other way, he doesn't feel right. He then plays four games, is out again, plays two, you know, he gets injured, misses eight, plays four, misses 13, plays two, misses three, then plays for an extended period of time. Sits one in Dallas right on a back end of a back-to-back right before the All-Star break. And then plays about nine, sits two, plays about nine, sits six, and then plays the final two games of the regular season, seven playoff games for nine and sits three. I mean, so he never he links 10 games together from from January 7th to February 8th. And then never does again. And so that's that. We'll talk about that going forward. I mean, that's the huge question mark about George Hill going forward. But that's That's the summary of the season. He brought everything you could have asked him to bring. He brought a career high, or right off a career high, 47.7 field goal percentage his second year in San Antonio's 47.8. His three-point shooting was 40%. His free-throw shooting was 80%. He's not a huge assist guy. He's not a natural point guard per se. He brought the leadership. Interestingly, kind of off the court, he's a gabber. He talks all the time. Where to the media, he's a little quiet, pretty reserved. He brought 80 playoff games of experience and 7 series wins, and he brought that. And that's what the Jazz needed and wanted from him. And he absolutely showed all of those things. 17 games post All-Star break when he was able to play, 48% from the field, 43% from three, 16 points per game. The 20 or more in 15 games, the Jazz went 15-1. When he hit 19, they were 19-2. That shows the incredible importance and value to this franchise of a second scorer. With Rodney Hood's crazy inconsistencies, not like you understand what I'm saying, like his inconsistencies. There's no question when Gordon Hayward got help, Rudy Gobert became pretty consistent, this team won. That's what George Hill brought. And George Hill, if we dig into some of the other aspects, has some pretty special things to his game. If we kind of dig in, he's one of the better pack players in the league. Pack is points above average created, that I think you've probably heard enough about at this point to know what it is, but it's my metric on offensive players. He's one of the elite point guards in the NBA. If you listen to Locked On NBA this week, we talked about that. But if we grab just the point guards this year in Pack, number one in the league is Isaiah Thomas, 2 Steph Curry, 3 Kyle Lowry, 4 Chris Paul, 2 of those free agents, Mike Conley, Dame Lillard, and then George Hill at 1.3 positive. So he's right up in that elite list of efficient offensive possessions. He's not a guy who is, you know, a true point guard. I think that became clear as well over time. Is that, you know, he's just not a truly distributor. He's not making a ton of plays that are opening up opportunities for his teammates. We'll look at a few other things, but let me take a second and thank our sponsor today, Blue Apron. I really am thanking Blue Apron. If you follow me on social networks, you saw that my wife was out of town Saturday with our daughter, and so my son and I whipped out a Blue Apron together. We had a really good chicken with udon noodles, asparagus, and carrots. It was fun to do together. According to one of my friends on Facebook, I'm not cutting the carrots correctly in the picture. You know, I'm learning, but it was fun. And there's an element to that of Blue Apron. Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often together. So you're building some bonds. My son, who's actually good in the kitchen, and I did it together. The signature to Blue Apron is that they're the number one fresh ingredient recipe delivery service in the country. They make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, and they do it with partnerships with 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranches. So the ingredients are good. They arrive to you with a recipe sheet, and then each of the ingredients is already parceled out for you, so you don't have to be buying way too much of something at the grocery store. It comes with step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe. Trust me, I did it. We got that one done in probably a little less than 30 minutes. The freshness guaranteed. It's really, really fun. Check it out. We're a Blue Apron family now and enjoying it. We go and grab, I think, 2 a week. You can do 3 a week. You can do 4 a week. If, you know, it's a great way if everyone's busy and the kids are around everywhere and you still want to get a good meal rather than stopping at fast food somewhere. And it's about $10 per person per meal with seasonal recipes, great variety in everything. Beef teriyaki stir fry with sugar snap peas and lime rice is up right now. Baked spinach and egg flatbread with sauteed asparagus and lemon aioli. We had a really good lemon turkey burger with lemongrass recently. They had a crispy salmon with roast potato salad. So creativity in the menus, and we have enjoyed it as a family and the freshness guarantee. So go to blueapron.com/lockjazz. That's lock, L-O-C-K, jazz. And get your first 3 meals for free. That's Lock Jazz, LOCKJAZZ at blueapron.com/lockjazz, no E, and get your first 3 meals for free. We're enjoying being a Blue Apron family. I'm sure you will as well. All right, let's go to some of the tracking Interesting kind of numbers we have now on George Hill. He was a 50% corner three shooter post All-Star break. So two things that George Hill came to us, we knew about George Hill when we got him. One is he had become one of the elite catch-and-shoot guys in the NBA, and he was a great, great corner three shooter. And that actually was where his injuries were most obvious, because Shelvin Mack and Dante Exum, really very, very poor corner three shooters. And that became obvious the amount of times they got open looks. But what was so great about George Hill is he is one of the best. That catch-and-shoot thing is true. 40% catch-and-shoot this year. The year prior in Indiana on catch-and-shoot threes, he was 45%. So he followed through. I mean, you get him a good catch-and-shoot look, that is going down. And that was a great luxury for the Jazz offense. What he added was a pull-up. On the pull-up, he was at about 41%, which give Igor Kokoschkov and some of the coaches he worked with some credit on that, because that's helping him get better balance and better understanding the offense and where he's going to get his shots. He was a 31% off-the-bounce shooter the 2 years prior. He was both a 30 and 31%. So for him to jump to 41% was a real developmental step for him. It's why he had some career highs across the board. Angle right, 41%. Angle left, 40%. Left corner three, 48%. Right corner three, 38%. I mean, his left corner three is deadly. Really impressive development in that regard. When you go to look at George from a synergy standpoint, some of those 92nd percentile pick and roll player. I mean, when this guy is on the floor and healthy and playing well, he really brought a tremendous amount. He goes off the pick 89% of the time, so he's not going to beat you one-on-one in much of any capacity. His effective field goal percentage when somebody went under on the pick and roll this year was 91%. Effective field goal percentage, 91% if a defender goes under on the pick and roll. That's number one in the NBA. So that's where the off-the-bounce game that was added to him through the coaches he worked with the Jazz really, really changed who he is. Career high points, field goal attempts, 3 points attempt, effective field goal percentage. Because of our time out there. When they went under the pick and he was on the bounce, he was the best shooter in the NBA, which is pretty incredible. And his value to this team is, you know, really unquestioned when you look at the on-off numbers of what he did. Now, one thing that's interesting, and again, this is what gets a little tricky about George, is quite frankly, as much as big a fan as I am and as much as I wanted him for 3 or 4 years, there's some real question marks here on his health. You have to kind of question and wonder about. So here, remember how good his numbers were post-All-Star break? Shooting, well, let's dig in a little bit on that, because when George Hill was on the floor versus off the floor, there's no question we were better when he was on the floor this year. But when you start to delve into pre-All-Star break, post-All-Star break, which is where you begin to wonder, two things I think happened to George this year. The toe hurt him, then the groin acted up, and then I don't think he was in very good shape because, or as, you know, he's an elite, elite, incredible shape kind of player, so that when I think that suddenly you see him at times not having the impact. So when he was on the floor this year, our offense was a 101.8. When he was off the floor, it was a 103.8. Okay, so that's, you see that, and you can see just that's 2.3. That's clear. That's his impact. We go to post-All-Star break, and suddenly the defensive numbers jump. He was not as solid a defensive player post-All-Star break. His defensive rating post-All-Star break was a 104.6. The Jazz as a whole post-All-Star break, when they went away from the Rudy Gobert, Derek Favors lineup to much more of the Rudy Gobert, Joe Johnson lineup, were not as good defensively, frankly. Even Rudy was only a 102.6 during those time periods. I think that'll be a real question actually going forward for the Jazz of whether or not they can maintain the defensive identity that they had while spreading the floor. But that's a different side note. So his defense was not as good in the second. The other one that's interesting on George, much better at home shooting than on the road, 10 percentage points better from three, vital in wins, and then he shot 12 percentage points better against the East and 13 percentage points better from three against the East. Will that straighten itself out because he gets to know the West better if he stays, that'll be the case. So on the defensive thing where I was a second ago with George, the question is a little bit of, you know, is that because George suddenly was not quite as sharp because of the foot or the physical conditioning because of the injuries? Or was that because of the fact that we just weren't as good defensively? The offense, interestingly, post All-Star break with him off the floor was a 109.3. With him on the floor was a 106.1. That foot really bothered me. I go to that Sacramento game where he just, you could see he couldn't run. And so he'd bring the ball up and he'd sit on it a little bit. There were just some strange times watching him where you could just tell he was not what he is. So let's look at his future. So his future is that he's a free agent. And the Jazz have his bird rights. And what that means is if the Jazz want to re-sign George Hill, they can re-sign him to any salary that fits inside the collective bargaining agreement while going over the salary cap. So the Jazz can go over the cap to sign their own player, which is the essence of I'm pausing here for a second because I kind of came to a realization the other day. I was at a season ticket a meeting with a bunch of Jazz staff people that there's so much I have way too much assumed knowledge sometimes when I talk about things. So let me go back. So the way the salary cap works is you're either under or over the cap. You can only sign a free agent who is not on your team with the money you have under the salary cap. If the player is already on your roster and has been for long enough, or you acquired him in a fashion that you can, just kind of work with me on that, you have something called bird rights. And the bird rights allow you to sign a player for as much as the collective bargaining agreement allows without worrying about whether you're under or over the cap. So in the case of George Hill, we can just sign George Hill to whatever number we can agree to with George Hill as a team that's over the salary cap because we have his bird rights. So, you know, if we, in the scenario here is we re-sign Gordon, we're over the cap, we then re-sign George, and then it's just a question of whether we're willing to go over the luxury tax or what we try to do there. We cannot sign him until July 1st when free agency starts. We cannot sign him, and really legally, until about probably the moratorium ends. And we cannot do anything with him prior to that. And you cannot trade him prior to July 1st. And so while he is going to be out looking around at all of the teams in the league, and we're negotiating with Gordon Hayward at the same time, it's going to be a tricky circumstance. One thing I've mentioned is the Jazz have a window prior to July 1st where they could solidify their point guard situation to try to secure re-signing Gordon. And that would then mean moving on from George Hill, which, would be disappointing because George is really, really good, but it might be the best option for the franchise, which is often the case. All right, so let's go look at free agency, who the suitors are, and what might happen with him. Before we do that, on what seems to be a fairly topical item today, our today's show is brought to you by Gemalto, a global leader in digital security, bringing trust to an increasing connected world. And as we're seeing today, all sorts of crazy stuff can be out there. So what you need to do is you need to protect what matters where it matters. So protect your data at rest, protect your IP, your intellectual property, protect your reputation, protect your personal identifiable information, your financial information, your credit card information, social security numbers, all your other data. Data is the gold. The bad guys are after it. And so you have got to make sure as a company that you can control what is happening. Control the access to what. Passwords no longer enough, so you need multi-factor authentication, something from the smallest companies to the largest enterprises. This is, you have to be doing this at this point in time. And Gemalto is the global leader in this, and Dan Spence is the local sales manager. You can reach Dan at 801-540-3024. That's 801-540-3024. He's local to Utah, can be contacted by email, dan.spence@gemalto.com or 801-540-3024. The breach is going to happen. Protect what matters, where it matters with Gemalto. All right, let's go look at the potential suitors. So the point guard, I think George Hill, if you look at point guards is fourth on the list. Number one, Kyle Lowry. Number two, Chris Paul. I don't know. I would take that back. I have him as, well, Steph Curry's a free agent, but I don't think anyone thinks he's going to. I actually have George Hill ahead of Jrue Holiday. So I would have George Hill at three. Let's go. All right, so Steph is one, and he's going to stay. Chris Paul is two. We don't know what he's going to do, but I would assume he's going to stay in L.A. because he wrote the new collective bargaining agreement to get himself this huge amount of money, and I can't imagine that he wouldn't get it. Kyle Lowry is three. Jrue Holiday is four. George Hill is five. Jeff Teague is unrestricted and at six. Derrick Rose is seven, and then there's a pretty good drop-off. So now let's go to the teams of who has cap space. Now, the obvious one right out of the chute that gets interesting is Philadelphia does not have a point guard. Kyle Lowry is being talked about there. They have $53 million. Chicago has a bunch of cap space if they let go, but Wade's got a player option at $24 million that eats it up. Rondo's partially guaranteed. I don't see that. I don't really see Chicago as a suitor. Sacramento's got a possibility of some cap space. They don't really have a point guard since Darren Collison and Ty Lawson were their point guards last year. And maybe he goes to Sacramento, but that'd be surprising. Brooklyn has a bunch of cap space and willing to do something. Depending what Denver does with Gallinari, they've got a little bit of space. Dallas, who has got a weird collection of point guards and likes veterans usually, is a possibility. And then we kind of fall off the map here pretty fast before you find teams that have point that are willing to have point guards, are willing to do things. And then you kind of wonder who's going to maneuver. So here's what gets interesting, by the way, is if Lowry leaves Toronto and goes to Philadelphia, that takes them off the market. If Holiday goes somewhere and say he goes to Brooklyn, takes them off the market, Chris Paul stays with the Clippers, George Hill's market gets thin very, very fast. If Lowry and Holiday stay in Toronto and New Orleans, then his market's pretty robust. But what's unique about both Toronto and New Orleans is in all likelihood, if those players leave, they don't have cap money to go re-sign another player, if that makes sense. So if Toronto's maximum amount of cap space that they could come up with if they lose everybody along the way is like $22 million. But that's like releasing everyone. So they're not really, if Lowry leaves, they're really out of luck. New Orleans' max cap space, if Jrue Holiday leaves, is like $14 million. So if Holiday leaves, they're out of luck. There are some other teams that can play in here. I'm minimizing a little. Atlanta decides that, you know, well, I don't know what they're doing with Dennis Schroeder. And Chicago is maybe more interesting than I'm giving them credit for if they really, but I'm not sure that they're really willing to roll out that kind of money. And Denver, depending what they decide to do with Moutier, might be of have some level of interest there. I don't think he goes back to Indiana after all of that. Minnesota's got both Rubio and Dunn, so I don't think that's a player. But Philadelphia obviously has huge amount. Phoenix is interesting, but they have Bledsoe, so I can't really see. And Sacramento. So the point here is that when it all starts, if Lowry goes to Philadelphia, they're off the market. Toronto can't replace with George Hill. Brooklyn. What does Jrue Holiday do? Does he stay in New Orleans or does he go someplace? Now that market gets really thin really fast. One team that's talked about a lot is the Spurs. Now the Spurs have no cap space next year as long as they pick up the player option on Pau Gasol, which they may decide they don't want to do. If you watch the reaction sometime from the likes of Pop, that would make sense. If they let Pau Gasol go, they do have $24 million of cap space. However, that's a little misleading. That's with only 11 players under contract. So that number starts to work its way down because you have to account for future draft picks. You have to account for roster holds. That would mean no Jonathan Simmons, no Pau Gasol, no Patty Mills. The minute they try to re-sign Jonathan Simmons or try to re-sign Patty Mills, if they want to, then they don't have a lot of money for George Hill. Then all of a sudden, what the Jazz have with the Bird rights, being able to go pay him, is more than anything San Antonio could give him. So the overall takeaway here is San Antonio could probably clear a bunch of space to pay him a lot, but it'd be very painful to them. It would cost them Gasol and Simmons and Mills in all likelihood, unless they pulled off something with Simmons. There are teams, Philadelphia, Brooklyn, that aren't going to have a real chance to win that can pay him. Of teams that have a really big chance to win that could pay George, that just does not seem – I don't see a lot out there. Denver's got a possibility. They've got a lot of roster flexibility right now. And I am having a hard time finding other teams out there where they would go do that. Milwaukee's got about, I think, if they do everything in kind of a unique fashion, have some room, and they need a point guard a little bit, so they could be a suitor. But not a big number suitor. I don't think they have enough money to go do big number things, and they've got a bunch of players whose money is changing. So the point on this is there's two scenarios. George goes and gets the money, which you can't discredit him for at all. Two is he's probably third or fourth on the list, so therefore other players are going to go first, and as they go, his market could get slim. And then the final aspect of all of it has to be, quite simply, what do you do about a guy that played 49 games? And how serious is that toe injury? And that's the last thing that clearly has to be decided in this process. All right, that's a pretty good summary of George Hill. I am now going to kind of take the NBA, national look on the NBA things with the 60 dB, and I'm actually just going to record it straight into the back end of this program for you. Hi, it's David Locke of Locked On NBA and at Locked On Sports on Twitter for 60 dB with your Locked On NBA big stories of the league. The story of the Warriors' incredible 113-111 win over the San Antonio Spurs. The Spurs dominated this game, led by as many as 25. Then Kawhi Leonard got hurt and left the game. What were the things the Spurs were doing to cause the Warriors so much problems? On the offensive side, they were able to run a high pick and roll with Kawhi Leonard attacking from the top. Pick set by LaMarcus Aldridge. Leonard was getting off the pick, and if the Warriors took the ball out of Leonard's hands, they were hitting Aldridge in the middle of the paint, and Aldridge was able to either create for himself, hit a mid-range jumper, or pass the basketball, moving it. Pau Gasol, a very good passer, could do the same. When Leonard went out of the game, all of a sudden, the Spurs didn't have that option, which left them with the next thing that they went to, which was their post-up game of LaMarcus Aldridge. And even though analysis from commentators all the time, you got to pound it down low, it's one of the least efficient plays in the game. And that's what happened as the game rolled on and the Spurs no longer had the creator off the pick and roll in Kawhi Leonard, no longer had the creator on the pick and roll because Tony Parker was out, so they couldn't run the same thing. Then they ended up with only the post game to LaMarcus Aldridge. It lost effectiveness as one of the league's best defenders, and Draymond Green guarded him throughout. Pau Gasol couldn't get things going, played only 16 minutes, and seemed to have the ire of Coach Greg Popovich. So the Spurs offense with Kawhi Leonard just completely fell apart. Warriors then attacked defensively, were able to get into the passing lanes and disrupt things. And frankly, at some point in time, the Spurs weren't even able to complete passes. On the flip side of things, and when you look at what the Spurs were able to do to disrupt the Warriors offensively early in the game, the Warriors, who are an assist-laden team, 30-plus assists in over 50 games this year, only had 22 assists in this game. Draymond Green had 7 of them, many of them coming in the second half when the Warriors started running the offense through the post into Draymond. But the other aspect of things was that the Spurs got the Warriors out of their natural rhythm. The Warriors are a collective group that kind of finds a collective energy out of moving the ball and everybody touching it and everyone contributing, and that's not who they were in this game. They were playing a lot of one-on-one. They were having to play a lot of mid-range pull-up jumpers, unassisted twos kind of game, and that got them undone in the first half of the game. Now they got out rolling, and Steph Curry was a genius in the second half. 40 points on 26 points for Steph was absolutely unbelievable in the key. Klay Thompson was just awful in this game. 2 of 11 from the field, didn't have the same defensive presence usually did till late. He got a few steals late in the game, blocked a shot or two, but for most of the game. And the Warriors' bench may have gotten a little thinner. Andre Iguodala played just 10 minutes, is having an MRI today. That's going to be a problem for them, is that he's vital to what they do and would take away some of their flexibility. But the bench of the Warriors suddenly looked as though it had the weaknesses that everyone has talked about all year long against a Spurs team. The Spurs, Manu Ginobili was just terrific, but he's the one guy without Parker and without Leonard who could just start beating you off the dribble and had the guts to take those narrow gaps and go to the basket. When you play the Warriors, they're going to switch the pick and roll so much that you can't run an effective pick and roll game unless you're able to have a playmaking big who can catch and make plays off that double team. And you run it up high enough so that it spreads them out and really creates a 4-on-3. That's what the Spurs were doing. The second thing is you have to have some sort of a post game. Aldridge and Gasol give the Spurs that. And third is you have to have breakdown one-on-one guys. And the only guy left on the Spurs without Tony Parker and without Kawhi Leonard is Manu Ginobili. Obviously, if this is going to be a series, Kawhi Leonard has to play. We have Game 7 tonight between Washington and Boston in this one. The story here is going to be whether or not Washington can play on the road. They have been just brutal on the road all season long. Incredibly good at home, but flat out brutal on the road. So will they play any better on the road against Boston than they have in the past? The starters for Washington all year long have been very, very good. Their bench has not been good. How much Scott Brooks is going to roll those starters out for the entire game, I think, is a huge story in this one. Whether or not John Wall is able to have the superstar performance that somebody must have in a Game 7 to win it. The spread has Boston by 5, largely because Washington is just such a poor road team. In this series, both teams are shooting well. Offenses are dictating the matchups and more often than not. And it will be interesting to see if either team can disrupt the other team's offense. That is your 60 dB NBA, Locked On NBA. Catch the podcast of Locked On NBA as well and all of our Locked On Podcast Network podcasts here at 60 dB. And follow me on Twitter at Locked On Sports. All right, that is it. See you guys. Have a great day.
The kids are playing and laughing. The house is filled with the life you've worked so hard to build. You're committed to protecting this life and everyone in it. Life insurance from USAA can help.
Call 1-800-531-LIFE for a quote.